Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking a little bit about neurobiology. Well, obviously, that's to do with the head, the way we think, the way we don't think, and, of course, degenerative diseases of the head are Alzheimer's is the one that everybody knows about, but we're going to discuss these things. And to discuss them with us, we've got Professor Ruth Perez. She's from the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. And Ruth, welcome to El Paso, Texas, and welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you so much, Keith. It's a joy to be here.
Well, I'm glad you think so, and I hope you think so at the end of the program also. So
we'll find out.
Let's start before we get on to neurobiology and the various degenerative diseases. Let's talk a little bit about Ruth. How did a nice lady like you become a scientist?
Well, the beginning was in my childhood. I loved the outdoors, and my parents were always gardeners. And I began by growing little crops of my own. And I loved watching my little beans and corn and things growing. And so that really was the beginning. I loved to be out and watch nature, but then we moved from Kansas when I was 9 and came to El Paso. And
oh, so you're a native of El Paso?
I am.
Well, almost native.
Almost.
Yes.
And when I got here from Kansas and saw the desert night sky, I went wild over the stars. And my folks signed me up for an Audubon weekly newsletter, and I learned the constellations, and I thought I was going to be an astronomer. But as luck would have it, things shifted, and I became a neurobiologist instead.
But, I mean, those little crops that you grew, you know, when you were in Kansas, mm-hmm. clearly you couldn't do that here.
Actually, we did.
You did.
We had a great garden here. We lived in Kern Place, and my dad did raised beds.
All right.
And we had beautiful crops here in El Paso. Mm-hmm.
Just as an aside, mm-hmm. whereabouts? I live on Cincinnati Avenue.
We were on Robinson.
Oh, just mm-hmm. around the corner.
Yeah.
All right. So then anyway, you looked at the stars and then you became a neurobiologist. So tell us, what is a neurobiologist?
A neurobiologist is a person who studies neuron function. And neurons are the cells in the body, not just in the brain, but in the central nervous system and the peripheral nervous system that communicate signals and that make up our behaviors.
So every time you feel tickling or you mm-hmm. feel pain, mm-hmm. there's a neuron firing from one place to another.
Right.
Well, what are they? What makes them so special? What's different about a neuron cell if they have cells?
They yeah. are cells, definitely. One thing that's very special is that they can transmit electrical impulses from one cell to the other. And they do this also by communicating through what are called neurotransmitters. And neurotransmitters are small molecules that are released from one cell and touch the next cell in the system and bind to receptors on that cell and set up new signaling pathways, change the flow of electrons in the cell and communicate and transmit that signal further.
So when you feel pain, it's not like there's a, you know, you pinch your little wrist here and then mm-hmm. all of a sudden there's a little molecule that goes up to the brain. It's just whole series of electrical signals
that
do this through mm-hmm. the nerve system.
Right.
What made you get interested in neurobiology?
Well, I'm a baby boomer, and when I came back to college, I got my undergrad degree, and then I was working at a laboratory in town I did cytogenetics and cytology, and I was ultimately called back to the university because I saw that I needed to be doing some counseling for some of the patients that would be coming for cytogenetic workups.
And cytogenetics, please.
Cytogenetics is the analysis of the chromosomes and genes within the cells. And so, for example, Down syndrome patients have a trisomy 21. And the way that was analyzed was you would get samples and look at the chromosomes, and you could say, were there extra chromosomes, were there broken chromosomes, were there deletions? And some of the families would bring the babies and say, why is the doctor ordering this test? And I felt inclined to get some counseling experience so I could help with that. And I came back to UTEP and met Donald Moss in the Department of Psychology and was invited to work with him in his lab. And as luck would have it, funding fell into place, and I quit my job, and I came back to school, and I never looked back.
Well, that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. And now you're a professor in the School of Medicine.
Yes.
In Pittsburgh.
Yes, I'm an assistant professor. All right. Coming up for tenure next year.
Oh, you're coming up for tenure next mm-hmm. year. So this is a stressful time.
It is. Exciting. And it's
Exciting.
A great time to bring my story on the road and to share it with others.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly. It's called the pre-tenure tour, right? Mm-hmm. That when people are up for tenure in universities, then they pull out the plugs and make contacts and
right.
get invited to give talks, etc.
Right.
So anyway, you're a neurobiologist. What are you specializing in this general big field?
I look at small proteins. Proteins are small molecules that make up, that are made of amino acids. And for example, for the layman, a protein would be, for example, like a hamburger is just full of protein, right?
Yeah,
or Jello. Right, yeah. Jello is just protein.
Right, so, yeah. And then they form patties, and you know, you don't want patties in your bloodstream, right?
Exactly. Right? You don't want them in your blood or your brain. But there are certain small proteins that tend to aggregate. They form abnormal clumps inside and outside of neurons in the brain. And very often when people know about these certain proteins, the first inclination is to shut them down or put them away or stop them, quit making that protein so that you don't have the problem. But because my PhD is in developmental neurobiology, I like to know what the normal function of a protein is. And I think the advantage of this is that we will learn what that protein does so that we can enhance that function, keep that protein intact and healthy, and prevent the disease from ever happening. That's my ultimate goal.
So the thrust of the idea then mm-hmm. is that you have the proteins, they begin to accumulate and agglomerate. Right?
Yes.
The implication of that is that they stop doing the original function?
That's true.
Or is it just that you keep making more of them? There's enough
it's
there
both.
To do
Those
the job.
Those are great questions because actually it's both. The thing is that definitely those proteins aggregate and that takes them out away from their normal function. But also if the cells are still healthy enough, they produce more of that protein. And the problem with the one that I study, the alpha-synuclein protein that I study, is that when you get higher levels, that tends to drive it to aggregate more avidly. And so here the cells are trying to compensate to make up for what's missing, yet they're causing a problem, creating more. And in the case of the alpha-synuclein, my lab has discovered that that protein is actually inhibiting dopamine synthesis. And dopamine is one of these small neurotransmitters.
It's one of the most famous ones.
It's one of the most famous.
Everybody has heard of dopamine
right.
if you don't know what it is.
Right.
What does dopamine do then? This is transmitting the electrical signal.
It actually is released from the dopamine neuron and binds to receptors called postsynaptic receptors and also on the presynaptic cells. So it's being released signaling to the next cell in the pathway, but then it gets taken back up by the cell that produced it.
So it's a nice catalytic process. I mean, it's conserving the dopamine
it
all
is.
The time. It's not
it
being
is.
Consumed.
And the major pathway that dopamine regulates that I study is a movement pathway, and that's through the substantia nigra, the nigrose striatal pathway, which regulates normal body movement.
So like moving my arms and my wrists
yes,
and things of that
walking.
Nature.
Yes, walking.
Can you replicate those symptoms in animals? Because you clearly don't work with human subjects, or at least I say that.
Right. Well, I don't work with human subjects. Most of my work, since it's focused on normal function, personally I don't replicate that, but many people have generated models that replicate the movement abnormalities associated with Parkinson's disease.
So what precisely do you do then? You've got your little proteins
mm-hmm.
and you're finding how they accumulate or aggregate?
Actually,
and then
what I'm doing is looking at the normal function of my proteins, what they interact with, what those interactions do for the neurons, and what happens when the balance gets tipped and the proteins aggregate. And does that shift dopamine synthesis? Does that affect the level of dopamine that might be accumulating? if dopamine is in a cell, it needs to be packaged into vesicles, these small vesicles that keep it safe inside the cells. But if it's not in the vesicles, it's not safe. And in fact, it's very reactive, and it creates free radicals that can damage that cell. And so having just the right balance of dopamine being synthesized and released is very critical. And that's where my protein of interest, the alpha-synuclein, comes in.
So what does that protein do then? Does it create more dopamine outside of the little vesicles? Or
you are like four steps ahead of me here. I can take you there with my model.
Okay.
So normally, in a normal healthy cell, alpha-synuclein is working in counterpoint to another chaperone protein called 1433. And these proteins are regulating the balance of dopamine being synthesized. But with aging, what happens is that synuclein levels go up. 1433 levels are always high. They don't go up, but synuclein goes up. And what that does is it shifts the synthesis to inhibiting dopamine synthesis. But because dopamine is such an important neurotransmitter, the system works to compensate and overcome that. At the same time, the levels of synuclein are getting so high, they begin to form aggregates called Lewy bodies. And those Lewy bodies take the normal synuclein away from its normal function. And that can shift toward a 1433 push, make too much dopamine. It can be toxic to the very cells that are making it.
Okay.
And then those are the cells that are dying in Parkinson's brain.
What is it about aging that causes this overproduction?
That's another good question, and no one knows that right now. But what's been discovered for alpha-synuclein is that stresses can also increase it. If you're using cell culture models, in fact, that's what we do as well. We use cell cultures. If we just stress our neuronal cells, they increase their synuclein levels.
How do you stress a cell? You just might listen to Sibelius symphonies all day? I mean, what does stress mean to
you? For a cell culture, if the pH is out of balance, that will stress the cells.
Right.
So we can let the pH get more acidic. That more acidic pH will set up signaling in the cells and then turn on transcription of alpha-synuclein and the levels go up.
Okay, I can see that particular stress. Give me another one.
In the brain, what might stress us? Just everyday life. I mean, that over a lifetime of stress-related behaviors, needing to multitask, it may be that in the aging human brain, that is a factor. And that's why it's so important for people to have good diet, good exercise, really take good care of themselves and try find ways to relieve the stress so that your brain can function well.
And always be on time. And that means we've got a break. This is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Professor Ruth Perez, University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neeson. If we didn't brush, the bacteria in our mouths would flourish and destroy our teeth and gums. But it wasn't always like this.
That's because in the hunter-gatherer days, humans had different bacteria in their mouths. Two recent studies reveal the development of agriculture about 8,000 years ago allowed the present bacteria to emerge. But why?
Farming radically changed how people lived, shifting away from Stone Age societies and providing a large, reliable food supply. This incorporated much more grains or starch into the human diet.
Enzymes in the mouth split the starch into shorter chains of sugars, leaving a residue of sugar in a film on and between teeth. This created an ideal environment for bacterial growth, which researchers found on ancient teeth tartar.
They compared the teeth of Northern Europe's last hunter-gatherers with early farmers from Germany. The farmers had a sharp increase of bacteria, such as Streptococcus mutans, that cause cavities and periodontal disease. Now we know these bacteria also contribute to diabetes and cardiovascular diseases.
Surprisingly, the diversity of these bacterial populations stabilized for thousands of years until the mid-19th century. From then until now, strep mutans became even more dominant due to the Industrial Revolution.
That's when refined grains and concentrated sugars entered our diet, creating an even more suitable environment for oral decay.
What researchers did not consider is the impact of teeth brushing and fluoride. Even more interesting would be knowing how our fast food diet fits into the picture today.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Ruth Perez, University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. We're talking about degenerative processes in the brain. And you just were mentioning all about stress. And then you said, well, there's the stress of pH, which is abundantly clear, but to me anyway. But then you go on to the normal stresses of day-to-day life. Okay, I feel anxious sometimes, or I did before a test. And now I feel anxious before I grade a test because I want the students to do better than I think they will. Can you clearly delineate that that's a negative for a lifestyle?
I don't think so. I think there are positives and negatives associated with certain stresses. But if it gets too high and too sustained and that you're always reacting with some level of anxiety, I think that can be unhealthy. And there need to be ways to find to diffuse that so that you keep your brain and body healthy.
So, I mean, in fact, that would be the post-traumatic syndrome that a lot of military people get. I mean, mm-hmm. and clearly that's a real problem.
Absolutely. And it's very important for people to find outlets and supports where they can help rebalance their homeostasis.
So when you were saying earlier that you started out and came back to school because you needed to learn more about counseling, mm-hmm. do you think, in fact, that's an interesting sort of line of thought, that if we had more counselors and fewer physicians, going out on a limb here, but, you know, it seems to me that it's like in the old days, everybody went to church, and so there was a father confessor, mm-hmm. you know, and he could listen and give some words of wisdom. We don't have very much of that anymore. And, you know, is there an argument that we need more and more counselors, people really skilled in how people deal with their own stresses rather than always going for a pill?
I would go for that, but that's just my own opinion. I think people need to have supports at every level in their lives. If the family isn't there to be supportive, find someone else. Have good friends. Have whatever it takes to find that support. Or if it's prayer, if it's meditation, if it's reading uplifting stories, find something to soothe your mind so that it can be less stressed.
I mean, do many people, people doing research in this area in the sense of neurobiology? I mean, for me, exactly, I made fun of Sibelius just now, but in fact, he's one of my favorite composers. Mm-hmm. I mean, that to me is incredibly restful and yet stimulating at the same time. Do you know much about people doing work on music and neurobiology?
I don't personally, but I know it's out there.
Let's talk a little bit about the role of women in science.
I mean, great.
You're obviously a shining example.
Thank you.
And if I might say so, a late bloomer.
That's not true.
Like you just came straight from high school, then university, PhD,
right.
and then tenure track.
Right.
You've had life experiences, and yet you're still doing something which is incredibly very high-level science in an area that we don't really know much about. Tell me, was being a woman something that you felt held you back at the beginning, and then as times changed, positions became open?
Interesting question. I think my path has been so bizarre. It might be tough to correlate me with anyone in the world, but I think the bottom line is that being a woman in America, whether you're in science or anything, it's an uphill battle, and I don't think it's so different now than it was before. I think there are stigmas attempted to be placed on people who would hold women back, but I think the general tendency is still that men are the better scientists, that men are the ones who get promoted more directly. And what I would say to any woman listening to this program is that if you have a passion and you have a goal, just go for it. Don't let anyone or anything get in your way, because that's what you were put here for. And there have been plenty of impediments put in my way along the way. And I just decided that if I was meant to do this, because my commitment is to making a difference in this field, and I want to find ways to prevent disease onset and to cure disease if it's begun. And I'm committed to that, and I'm going to do that. Some way, somehow, I'm going to do that. And the only way to do that is to keep going. No matter what gets in your way, find another way around it. Just like a stream trickling down a mountainside. Mm. If this place is blocked, flow another way and find what you need to get where you're going.
Is that, in a sense, it's a personal question, is that why, in fact, you're a late bloomer, because you had these little boulders
that made you
meander all over?
In a way, that's true. I'm one of the first generation in my family that ever went to college. And in fact, I went to Loretto Academy. I had a good education. I had went to private schools. And I was always expected to do well, but no one ever expected me to go to college. It was my own excitement about I didn't even know I was so good at science. At Loretto, I liked it, so I did more of it. I took physics. I didn't have to, but I did. And I did well at it. And then I went to science fairs, and I won science fairs. And it was just like it was so much fun. It didn't seem like work, or it didn't even seem special.
Well, you see, now if that was the case, I mean, this was in the 70s, early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
But now in the beginning of this 21st century, or not in the beginning, we were almost a decade into it seems to me that from my experience of running NIH research training programs, the impediments that then followed you, even though you'd done so well, are pretty much absent now. I mean, I say that in terms of the formal methodology whereby a student of your type when you were in high school and going to college would make progress. Now there are all sorts of paths out there. There are scholarships.
That's true.
I mean, the scientific community is now totally sensitized, to women, minorities, people from all over, different walks of life and different experiences moving into science. Those weren't there then.
Actually, I was really fortunate when I came back to UTEP for my master's. I did get involved in the programs that were designed to help women and minorities in science. And they opened doors for me, so that part is true.
But you still think, though, that there are some major thought processes in the science community that women aren't quite up to it.
Well, I'm not sure it's that blatant or that cold. I just think that people look across the room and say, oh, well, that tall, handsome man over there is probably the best scientist in this room, and that little short woman over here, maybe she's okay, but she has to prove herself, but I believe he's okay.
But I mean, you could the other way around too.
Yeah.
That tall, gorgeous looking blonde over there, you know, rather than this stubby little short fat guy over there.
Stereotypes are stereotypes.
Yeah,
and you're absolutely right. Human nature is human nature.
Right.
And I may be wrong, but I feel that even now it takes a little more effort to make it if you're
as a
woman
female
in science.
Do you have a big research group?
I actually do now. I'm
yes.
really fortunate. I've got good funding right now. I have 3 postdocs, 1 graduate student, and 4 undergrads right now.
And how many of those are female?
About half.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Because the latest statistics that there are more women studying in universities and more women going into science than men, right? At least that's for the American population.
And they say that women start, but they fall out of the system when they have families. So that's another thing I want to encourage people, that I did this differently. I already had my family when I came back to school,
right?
And they were very supportive. So it can be done. And if you're in it and you want a family, find ways to work that out and stay in it if it's your passion.
Yeah, I mean, that is one of the issues. A lot of the students I mentor are female, and they go away and get PhDs, and they want careers in the academic environment.
Right.
But they also want families. And,
right.
And there are not so many role models for female faculty with family. I mean, they exist.
That's
but
true.
But it's not so prevalent as males with family.
Absolutely. And it just takes finding the right partner and the right external supports, and just don't give up. Just go for what you want to do and do your best. if you have to take a different route, take a different route, but get what you want and add to what the world will benefit by with your knowledge.
Yeah. Let's just go back. You're saying that you want to make a difference. You want to get disease out the way, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. There's an awful lot of people in the world, and we're finding all sorts of methodologies to extend our lives, but we're not finding methodologies to produce any more good water or, you know, in any more arable land, and the climate's variable.
Mm-hmm.
How far can we go?
You mean medically?
Yeah, medically
and curing disease and socially. Perfectly wonderful questions. And recently, before my funding was in place, and I must say I'm very grateful to Barack Obama and the stimulus funding, because my grant had scored very, very well and was beyond the pay line because grant funding had been cut back so extremely with the war effort. And so I'm really grateful I've gotten my funding in place again. And during the time when it wasn't clear whether I would have funding, and I was thinking, what will I do? What will I do if I have to quit this? And I'm also a tree hugger, and I love the environment, and I love nature. So I had made the decision that somehow, some way, I would become invested in cleaning up the environment and helping educate the average person that there really is a concern about global warming, because even in my own family, there are people who don't believe it. They think this is just God's way of doing a cycle. And that may be true, but there's plenty of evidence that suggests that we have pushed that cycle to the edge. And so I had made a commitment that if I couldn't keep up my neurodegeneration research, that I would find a way to make a difference for the whole world some other way. And so if it's not curing disease, if we cure our planet, we cure lots of things. So.
If we heal our planet,
then we have sustainable land. We've got minds in this world that are so brilliant. There's hydroponics, they're growing things. There are plants that can grow in air. There are people who can do all sorts of recombinant technologies. There will be ways to overcome the concerns. If we can keep our air clean, our water clean, and our temperatures in balance, it's going to work out. Somebody will figure out a way.
It's a beautifully American vision that we're clever enough to make new technologies and new ways of doing things that will allow us to keep on growing. But at some stage,
we're not meant to continue to grow. Maybe we're supposed to settle down and even out, and bigger isn't always better.
Well, Ruth Perez, it's been very nice listening to you talk about your science and a little bit here about your philosophy. And I congratulate you.
Thank you.
We don't see too many people on Science Studio that have gone through this process like yourself of starting out with a goal, going away, having a family, coming back as a mature student, and then progressing on now to faculty position, doing cutting-rate research. Thank you for being here.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
And thank you, Norma Martinez, for putting this all together, and thank the audience out there. We shall be back next week. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Texas Tech's University Breast Care Center recently received national accreditation. That makes it the only nationally accredited breast care program in El Paso. Dr. Manuel de la Rosa, founding dean of the Paul Foster School of Medicine, praised the achievement at a recent gathering, calling it yet another milestone in bringing higher standards of health care to El Paso. Read more in the region's Life Sciences News Digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.